It's nearly noon and time for the KMXT Midday News. Thank you for listening to KMXT on 100.1 FM. It's your public radio station, broadcasting from atop Signal Hill in Kodiak, Alaska, where it's 44 degrees. The temperature has gone up quite dramatically over the day so far. We're looking for rainy skies, mainly after 3 p.m., a high near 41 today, so we've topped that by a bit. For tonight, look for rain, mainly before midnight, then isolated showers, a low of about 37 overnight. South winds will go to 25 miles per hour, then turn to the southwest tonight, and could gust as high as 40 miles per hour overnight. For Veterans Day, look for scattered showers and cloudy skies, a high near 46, gusty winds from the south. Coming up on the midday news, Kodiak's community spread cases of COVID continue. The Borough Assembly acts to spend CARES Act funding before the deadline. A successful elk season has led to an early closure. And are Alaska's COVID-19 case counts being accurately reported? All that and more after headline news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President-elect Joe Biden is forging ahead with his transition, so far without the Trump administration's help or even its cooperation. Biden has yet to be given access to classified information, including the president's daily brief of intelligence that has traditionally been made available to the incoming president.
I just think it's an embarrassment, quite frankly. The only thing that, how can I say this tactfully? I think it will not help the president's legacy.
Biden is dismissing Trump's unsubstantiated claims of widespread voter fraud. He also focused on today's U.S. Supreme Court battle over the future of the Affordable Care Act. Trump and Republican allies in Congress have made several attempts at getting the law struck down. Trump is looking for support now from the high court's expanded conservative majority, but NPR's Carrie Johnson reports two conservative justices are expressing skepticism about throwing out the entire Affordable Care Act.
States led by Republican attorneys general are asking the court to strike down the Affordable Care Act. They argue the law's individual mandate, a requirement to buy insurance or pay a penalty, is no longer constitutional. But two conservative justices are casting doubt about whether the whole law could be invalidated. Chief Justice John Roberts pointed out Congress zeroed out the financial penalty for not having insurance, but Congress didn't try to repeal the entire ACA. Justice Brett Kavanaugh says keeping the rest of the law intact is pretty straightforward under court precedent. Throwing out the ACA could deprive more than 20 million Americans of health insurance during a pandemic. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
International reaction to Joe Biden's election victory is mixed. Many world leaders are congratulating the Democrat. Others are holding back. So is the Trump administration's top diplomat. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports on Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's remarks today.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was asked a simple question by a Fox News reporter. Is the State Department preparing to engage with the Biden transition team? And if not, at what point does a delay hamper a smooth transition or pose a risk to national security?
There will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. All right, we're ready.
He dismisses as, quote, ridiculous, all questions about President Trump's refusal to concede and how that could undermine U.S. efforts to promote democracy abroad. Pompeo also announced he's setting off on a Europe and Middle East trip on Friday. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
At the close, the Dow was up 263 points, or nearly 1%, at 29,421. The Nasdaq closed down 1.3%. This is NPR News.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
Despite a recent reduction in active cases as Kodiak residents recover from COVID-19, Community spread cases are still occurring. The Kodiak Area Emergency Services Organization reported two new cases in a release today. One is a Kodiak resident who is believed to have contracted COVID through an unknown community spread. The other is a close contact of a previously announced case. Contact tracing is underway. This brings the total case count to 146 since the start of the pandemic, with 16 cases currently classified as active. 9 individuals recently completed their isolation periods and have been removed from the active case total. With less than 2 months to spend CARES Act funding, the Borough Assembly met last week to spend more of the federal grant and prepare a project list for the upcoming state legislative session. KMXT's Jared Griffin has this overview of that meeting.
At last week's regular meeting, the Kodiak Borough Assembly welcomed newly elected members, Jeff Smith and Amy Williams, and went straight to work approving new CARES funding, discussing the new solid waste contract, and prioritizing a capital improvement list. In addition to $400,000 in support to the Emergency Operations Center and other entities, the CARES Act funding designates over $1.5 million in relief to Kodiak residents' solid waste bills. The relief was approved at the October work session, but last week's vote formally approved the use of CARES funds. According to a letter sent out by the Borough Finance Department, this one-time relief will be a $253 credit applied to Alaska waste accounts. But Kodiak residents will need to return their application by December 15th to get the credit on their account. The Assembly also approved a Capital Improvement Project Priority List, an annual list that is used to advocate for financial support from the state for large infrastructure projects needed in Kodiak. Assembly Member Dwayne Dvorak.
I think it's important that the justifications and need is expressed adequately, and that we're not just providing a wish list with a bunch of dollar figures, but that, you know, we've thought it through, and that, you know, we've, as things change over time and these things come back year after year, we know that we go back and update these things to be timely and accurate is, I think, extremely important in terms of making the best possible presentation.
On this wish list is the perennial request for $238 million to replace the Tustamina, which is riddled by, according to the priority list, ever-increasing maintenance challenges and costs. Among other requests, $2 million for the Peterson Elementary School roof, $3 million to pave and upgrade Otmaloy Way, and $2 million in improvements to the Anton Larson dock. Several recreational items are also on the list, $100,000 for the Sergeant Creek Community Playground, $500,000 to enhance Mill Bay Beach access, and $50,000 to improve Kodiak's trails. But just because it's on the list doesn't mean it will be funded anytime soon, as Assemblymember Julie Cavanaugh explains.
The average amount of time on this list is pretty high, like some of them have resided for more than 5, more than 10 years on this list.
The meeting ended with a send-off to former members Andy Schroeder and Rebecca Skinner. Schroeder ended his tenure by reflecting on the importance of local government.
I've been thinking back on what I've learned and trying to come up with a few truths that at least I believe that I could leave you with. And we try to create a structure where institutions can grow. The real fabric of the community is institutions, you know, and businesses, schools, and nonprofits, and churches, and things like that. And that's what make Kodiak Kodiak. But we are creating that framework which they can hopefully thrive.
After noting the polarized partisan culture in America right now, Schroeder concluded with this message to the Assembly.
I think we can govern with compassion.
For KMXT News in Kodiak, I'm Jared Griffin.
Thank you, Jared, and thank you, Andy. After a successful season of elk hunting on a Fognak Island, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has closed by emergency order elk hunting in the east of Fognak Hunt area.
We typically close down, certain portions of the registration hunt during any given year. This year, it was kind of interesting. We closed down pretty much the entire island, which I don't think we've ever done before, at least not that I can remember. So that seems to suggest that there's quite a few hunters out there, and not only that, but they're also being pretty successful.
Nathan Svoboda area wildlife biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak, says that the unusual closure of the entire island may not be entirely coincidental.
Yeah, I think people are kind of tired of being cooped up, so a lot of people are getting out in the field. I mean, we're seeing the same thing with our goat hunts. You know, we're reaching our harvest quotas a little bit earlier than we had in previous years.
The goal for the hunts is to take about 10% of the overall population, with that demand being lightened across the herds depending on their size. According to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, a particularly small herd may have little to no harvest quota, while larger herds will have large harvest quotas. There are 8 elk herds on Fog Neck Island. As of October 30th, hunters reported taking 18 elk from a quota of 24 in east of Fog Neck. A harvest that exceeds objectives could have the adverse effect of reducing future hunting opportunities. Registration hunts remain open for a portion of the remainder hunt area on Kodiak and Shuyak Islands. Only hunters with drawing permits may hunt elk on Raspberry Island. Alaska's COVID-19 case counts have spiked in recent weeks, according to data reported by the state. But the true number of positive tests is significantly higher than figures reported by Alaska's coronavirus dashboard, state officials say. That's because the state health department can't keep up with entering hundreds of new cases into its system each day, says epidemiologist Louise Castrodale.
In the early days when we had case counts under 10 or under 2 digits, it was super easy to have every case that was reported to you that day posted on the dashboard, validated that day. And then, you know, as the pandemic has increased and as the case counts have increased, we have growing but limited number of staff to evaluate all those reports.
As a rough estimate, Castrodale says that Alaska's case numbers are between 25 and 50% higher than what the state is reporting. It's hard to say exactly, she says, because the reason for the delay is to allow state workers to check and make sure each positive test is actually a new case, not one that's already been reported. That means cross-referencing things like birthdays or nicknames, and it could result in some of the reports being screened out. While the state has been trying to make some of its processes more efficient and automatic, Castrodale says it's clear the backlog isn't getting any smaller right now. And she says that even if the state is missing some cases, the dashboard is still showing a clear and concerning spike.
The take-home message is, like, regardless of the numbers are going up. They're not plateauing. And so that hopefully translates into people thinking, all right, well, I need to take this seriously, and I need to do what I can do to reduce those numbers.
Tiffany Zolkowski is a Bethel Democratic legislator who chairs the Health Committee in the State House. She says she thinks the gaps in the case counts show how Alaskan Republican Mike Dunleavy's administration is not using the data to guide its response to the COVID-19 pandemic. She says that while lawmakers have asked for it, the administration has refused to release specific numbers or measurements of the virus's spread that would cause the state to take specific actions in response.
There's been no communication. There's been no transparency. And we wanted to know, what's your mitigation strategy? At what point do you implement more stringent protective measures? And the response was, well, we have a mitigation strategy, but the public and the legislature has yet to see what that is.
Even as case counts have risen sharply in recent weeks, the governor has declined to impose specific restrictions or mandates like mask wearing or limiting the number of people in indoor spaces. Officials at J-Bear have declared a public health emergency in response to the community spread of COVID-19 and are tightening rules on activities for service members both on and off base. Among the restrictions, mask wearing is mandatory for all except people under 2 years old. Access to the base will be limited to essential personnel and contractors, and indoor gatherings are limited to 2 family groups. Those who meet with more than 2 family units, either on or off base, or eat or drink at restaurants or bars, won't be allowed back on base. Service members who violate the restrictions could be fined up to $1,000 and face a year in prison. The most recent round of testing shows that the coronavirus outbreak at Goose Creek Correctional Center at Point McKenzie has nearly doubled since last week. Results from the test taken on Thursday showed 47 new cases of coronavirus among inmates at the facility, which is the state's largest prison. That brings the total number of positives at the facility during the recent outbreak to 110. Goose Creek is isolating inmates who test positive in a designated unit, while others who may have been exposed to are quarantining in their cells. A spokesperson for DOC was not immediately available to clarify where inmates would be held if the number of positive cases exceeds the number of available isolation rooms. The new cases make Goose Creek the largest outbreak in the correctional system so far during the pandemic. The next largest at the Fairbanks Correctional Center had 104 at last count, according to a DOC spokesperson. Officials say they will continue testing all inmates that were in the same area as the positives every 3 days until all tests come back negative for 3 weeks. The first outbreak was reported last week. Alaska has more than 10,000 women veterans, but fewer than one-third are signed up for VA health services. Getting them connected to services as well as to each other is the object of a new program launched yesterday on Alaska Women Veterans Day.
The project is named after a WAC who made a huge difference for women in the military before she became an Alaskan for life. Colonel Mary Louise Milligan, who became Mary Louise Rasmussen, served from 1942 to 1962 and became director of the Women's Army Corps.
She was key in integrating the military, and one of her awards was actually for that.
That's Vanessa Mead, a U.S. Army Gulf War veteran who co-leads the project. She says Mary Louise Milligan created new opportunities for women in the military, particularly women of color. Now women veterans, as many as 10,000 in Alaska, need to be connected to services they are owed.
A lot of times women vets don't know that they're qualified for services.
On Monday, the Rasmussen Foundation, the Alaska Community Foundation, and the UA School of Social Work launched Operation Mary Louise. A new website, operationmarylouise.org, will share resources and raise visibility for Alaska women veterans. Ann Bullerdick, the VA Women Veterans Program Manager, says she knows women veterans are underserved.
We have about 10,240 women veterans in Alaska, and the VA system here in Alaska only serves about 25 to 2,600 of those veterans.
She says a lot of women encounter barriers in trying to get services, especially from the large bureaucratic Veterans Administration.
For women veterans or even male veterans, you don't know what you don't know. It is a big organization.
Mead is an assistant professor in social work. She's asking women to sign up on the Operation Mary Louise website to get regular updates about health and benefit issues specific to women veterans in Alaska. She also wants the project to increase the visibility and understanding of women and veterans.
We'll continue to work to ensure that all women veterans in Alaska have access to services they've earned and the resources they need. We want to thank every woman veteran for our service and know that we see and acknowledge you. We see and acknowledge you.
Mary Louise Rasmussen was inducted into the Army Women's Foundation Hall of Fame posthumously in March this year for all her work in integrating the Women's Army Corps. She served on the Rasmussen Foundation board here in Alaska for 45 years. She died in 2012 at the age of 101. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
Ketchikan is seeing record numbers of COVID-19 cases, but as KRBD's Eric Stone reports, emergency officials have stopped short of calling for a community-wide lockdown.
Officials say a record 74 people are infected with COVID-19 in Ketchikan as of Monday. More than 50 cases are tied to local restaurants. Ketchikan's pandemic response chief, Abner Hoag, says it's part of a widening outbreak of the coronavirus.
Our previous seven-day count is 10 community transmission cases, which goes over into the level 4 area of our risk indicator.
Level 4 is the top of the chart for community risk, but he says he's not ready to go there yet. Ketchikan has been at level 3 since last week, which reduced the time that students spend in classrooms. It's also asked businesses to adhere to voluntary restrictions. But the last 4 days has seen a reduction in the rate of community transmission, so Hoag says he's hesitant to push the needle further.
We're going to take the least measure possible to get the change that we want.
If the emergency operations center headed by Hoag were to go to level 4, that's very high, he'd recommend that the city issue a hunker down advisory and urge people to stay home. So why is that not happening now? Well, for one, Hoag says the community just recently moved to high risk less than a week ago.
2 days from going to level 3 to jump to level 4. One that seemed like a big jump to push the community through those hoops without giving a chance for these mitigation measures to take effect.
But also, Hoag says he's seeing some key measures of COVID-19 activity begin to decrease.
So the community transmission cases have started to trend down.
The positivity rate appears to be heading down, too, and 2 of the 4 positive patients at the local hospital have been discharged. Hoag says that together, those mean that Ketchikan may be getting a handle on this outbreak.
It does look like we potentially peaked over the weekend.
So for now, officials are urging people to wear their masks, wash their hands, keep their distance, telecommute, and think twice about risky activities. But they're not asking them to stay home or close their businesses. Yet. Of course, that could change. Hoag says that if community spread or another metric starts to rise again, pandemic response officials may consider stronger and possibly mandatory restrictions. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
The local news is supported in part by Ardinger's Fine Furnishings, home of the Tempur-Pedic Ergo Collection and the Tempur-Pedic Breeze, made especially for those who sleep hot. The Breeze cushions and supports you while channeling excess heat away from the mattress. Tempur-Pedic's Ergo Base allows you to move the bed into multiple ergonomic positions for sleeping or relaxing. 486-5554.
And by Arctic Physical Therapy Services, Incorporated. Professional rehabilitation for all your physical therapy needs. We repair the world's most complex machine. 813 Mill Bay Road, 486-4499.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. A draft plan on COVID fisheries payouts gets widely panned. A second chance to comment, more after this.
The Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute works to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. Learn more at alaskaseafood.org.
If a draft plan on how Alaska's $50 million share of federal fisheries assistance payouts gets the okay, the average sport charter operator would get nearly 10 times what commercial fishermen would receive. That's just one of the unexplained inequities pointed out by over 200 respondents. A second draft is now open briefly for public comment. Alaskans were asked in October by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to respond to a plan that outlined eligibility for seafood processors, commercial and sport fishing, and subsistence and aquaculture sectors. The money is part of the $300 million CARES Act. Nearly all of the responses questioned the equity and logic of how the funding pie was apportioned. United Fishermen of Alaska, for example, asked why the state increased the sport charter share from NOAA's recommended 5.5% to 32% of the $50 million. The sport boost came at the expense of the seafood processing sector without any analysis or justification, claimed the Alaska Salmon Alliance. Processors with over 50 employees were left out of the relief package despite paying $50 million or more on COVID prevention measures. Many groups also noted that payouts required that commercial fishermen be Alaska residents, but that's not required for sport charter operators. UFA also objected to Alaska's salmon hatcheries being excluded from relief funds. Subsistence users questioned how their 3% share was determined. Alaskans now have until November 15th to comment on the draft. Once it's finalized, eligible participants can apply for funds through the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission. Find links at the Fish and Game homepage and at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
Did you know that healthy eating can help prevent diabetes? Healthy Kodiak's Healthy Holiday Recipe Competition is an opportunity to rework favorite family dishes to be healthier. Consider cutting down on fats and sugar and increasing the amount of veggies or fiber. Once you've revamped your recipe, submit it to compete and you could win a prize. The competition has 3 age divisions, youth, young adult, and adults, so get your kids involved. For the full competition rules and judging criteria, go online to healthykodiak.net.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Tuesday. It is the 10th day of November, the year 2020. The sun rose today at 8:46. It won't set again until 5:02 p.m., getting us 8 hours and 15 minutes of precious daylight. That is a loss of 4 minutes and 20 seconds compared to yesterday. Rain is likely today after 3 p.m. They're calling for a high of 42, but it is 44 degrees right now. South wind to 15 miles per hour right now, should gust as high as 35 miles per hour today. For tonight, look for rain mainly before midnight, then isolated showers after midnight, a low about 37 tonight. South wind to 25 miles per hour will turn to the southwest, and winds could gust as high as 40 miles per hour overnight tonight. Your chance of precipitation tonight, 100%. For tomorrow, Veterans Day, look for scattered showers, mostly cloudy skies with a high near 46, south wind to 15 miles per hour, but could gust as high as 30. Chance of precipitation on Veterans Day, a mere 40%. Looking at our local tides, we have a low tide coming up here on the east side at 3:49 p.m. That will be a 2.8-foot tide. That will be followed by a high tide at 9:44 p.m. of 7.3 feet. Our low tide for the wee hours will be at 4:04 a.m. of 0.9 feet. And our high tide for tomorrow morning will be at 10:40 a.m. of 8.2 feet on the east side. Over on the west side, and these are Uganic Pass tides, you have a low tide coming up at 4:35 p.m. That will be a 4-foot tide, followed by a high tide at 10:27 p.m. of 12.6 feet. And your low tide in the wee hours will be at 4:49 a.m. of 1.7 feet. And your high tide tomorrow morning will be at 11:09 on the west side, a 14.6 foot tide. Mariners, here is your synopsis for the North Gulf Coast, including Kodiak Island waters and Cook Inlet. A front will enter the southwestern Gulf this afternoon, then move to the northern and eastern Gulf by Wednesday morning. A second front will move across the southern Gulf Wednesday through Wednesday night. The result of all that is a gale warning tonight and Wednesday for Marmot Island to Sitkanak, Kodiak's east side offshore. We have south winds to 30 knots right now and seas to 9 feet. For tonight, south winds to 40 knots, seas building to 16 feet. And for tomorrow, southwest winds to 25 knots, increasing to 35 knots tomorrow afternoon, 19-foot seas. And for Wednesday night, winds changing to the west and going to 40 knots, seas to 22 feet for Wednesday night on our east side. Very nice. The Shelikof Strait, gale warning tonight, south wind to 30 knots right now and seas to 9 feet. For tonight, southeast wind to 35 knots, seas to 11 feet. For tomorrow in the Shelikof, south winds to 25 knots, seas to 8 feet. And tomorrow night, west winds 35 knots, seas to 9 feet in the Shelikof. Inside waters, Chiniak and Marmot Bays. Chiniak Bay, gale warning tonight. Southwest winds to 20 knots right now. We'll go to the south 30 this afternoon. Seas building to 4 feet this afternoon. Tonight, south winds to 40 knots. We'll turn to the southwest and come down to 20 knots after midnight. Seas to 6 feet. Should subside to 3 feet after midnight in Chiniak Bay. And for tomorrow night, look for west winds to 25 knots and seas to 4 feet. Up in Marmot Bay, we have a gale warning tonight. South winds to 10 knots will increase to 25 knots this afternoon. Seas will build to 6 feet this afternoon. For tonight, look for southeast winds to 25 knots, turning to the southwest and coming down to 15 knots after midnight. Seas should subside to 2 feet after midnight in Marmot Bay tonight. And for Wednesday night, west wind to 25 knots, seas to 5 feet. Just a quick programming note. We have some changes for tomorrow as it is Veterans Day. KMXT will be observing Veterans Day and making some changes to the regular programming. Willie will be in, as always, and host the morning edition and local news, and then he'll be doing a morning show at 9 a.m. in place of the lowdown. Doc of the Rock will be back next week, so don't worry about that. Line 1 will air at 10, and performance today will run until noon. And we'll be running a fine Veterans Day special hosted by Alex Baldwin at noon. And then the afternoon programming will air unchanged, that being World Cafe and then Milk Street. We'll air All Things Considered from 4 to 6. There will be no local or state news. And then run a Veterans Day music program at 6 p.m., followed by our usual COVID evening shows. And happy Veterans Day from everyone here at KMXT. Just a quick look at the public meetings, what is going on tonight. We just have the Kodiak City Council having a work session. That's happening in the library multipurpose room, and it's open to the public. It is happening at 7:30 p.m. You will be asked to wear a mask and socially distance. For more information, call the clerk at 486-8636.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.
I believe so.
Okay. Welcome to this week's episode of Talk of the Rock. Joining me today is KMXT alum Anthony White, migrant education teacher for the Kodiak Island Borough School District. How are you today?
Yes, I am doing fantastic. Very tired, but good otherwise.
Wonderful. So, I hear that you are running a very interesting education to work pipeline sort of deal over at the high school. Could you please give us a rundown of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was hired as part of the federal program's migrant education department, tasked with developing migrant programs for migrant education students. But also one of the tasks was, can you help us build a work-based learning program? I believe last year, Travis Gannon had started the process of building this program, and then the torch was handed off to me. So I looked for resources from the state of Alaska. They had just come out with a handbook helping districts to build a work-based learning program, utilizing that information along with information from the state of Massachusetts and the state of Virginia, which have very robust work-based learning programs, compiled all that information together to create a handbook. And this handbook outlines a work-based learning program. So what is the work-based learning program? It is a hands-on experience for students to work in a job that is either directly tied to a class that the student is enrolled in, or wishes to gain experience in a specific career. So there are various levels of experiences available to the KIBSD students. This includes classroom visits and guest speakers. So we would invite community leaders, organizations, and businesses to come into the classroom and talk to students, elementary, middle school, even high school, to talk about what kind of careers are available within Kodiak and possibly the state of Alaska at large. And then we move on to hands-on experiences like a job shadow opportunity where the student just comes in for a couple hours, gets a feel for what things are, how things are run in the business, just kind of stand on the side and observe and kind of get to know the people who work in that business. And then it moves on into more hands-on experiences of externships and internships. So an externship, by this definition, is about 20 to 40 hours of a student in a business. They're not necessarily taking on a bunch of responsibilities within the business or organization, but they're getting, it's like a glorified job shadow pretty much, longer in duration, really getting to know the organizational structure of that business. And then it moves on into internship opportunity, which is much longer and includes much more hands-on experience for the student. So they're assigned projects and tasks. They take on those projects and tasks as part of the business, And they really get to understand the ins and outs of the organization and how it functions, culminating in, we're looking at 120 hours total for a student in a combination of job shadow, externship, or internship. 120 hours total. Plus,
over 120 hours over one semester.
So we're kind of feeling that out right now. Is it going to be a semester? At this rate, the way we're going right now with this semester, it's not going to happen in this semester. So it's going to have to extend for the full school year. In all honesty, I think in a perfect world, we would have a tracking system for the students, like a centralized database of student internship experiences that if they took this class, so they're enrolled in a class, it's called Workforce and Internship Readiness, and that really narrows down the skills that the student needs to learn in order to be successful in any kind of workplace environment. So the student takes the course and would earn one elective credit just by completing the course. If they complete 120 hours of an internship or combined experiences, they can earn an additional 0.5 credit towards graduation. So technically, by completing the course and internship, 1.5 elective credits, which is more than you can get in most other classes. But what we're seeing is I'm not sure it could be completed within a semester. Perhaps as this program grows and matures, we can make that happen. So to have a database where, say, the student takes the class his or her junior year, then their senior year, they're ready for an internship. We can track that in a centralized fashion, and the student isn't bound to do it just within that time frame, that they have a more extended time. So what if an internship spans 1 month here, but takes a break for another month and then starts again in another month? We're developing ways to be able to track that.
So the what specifically are students preparing for in these courses? Is it is your goal simply to build career skills, or are you thinking of this as something that will begin a long-term path for students to eventually arrive at very long-term goals involving higher education and a dream job, so to speak?
I mean, I would say all of the above, to be honest. The overall purpose of it is to provide students with practical and relevant career-related learning experiences. So through that, they're developing an understanding of their abilities, their interests, and educational career aspirations. They're provided with opportunities that don't currently exist within the high school's structure. So you're out in the workforce applying those skills. It helps develop the student's confidence, the student's responsibility, maturity. And I think one of the biggest things, it enhances the partnership between the school and the community by serving the local needs of business and industry. And it could be that the student has the experience. I mean, there's so many different ways that it could go. Student says, I'm really interested in X. Participates in that and says, not really sure about that, and then goes off in a different direction. Well, hey, we gave them that opportunity to explore. Is this something you really want to do? And so often kids don't necessarily have that opportunity. Or the student could follow X and find out that, oh my gosh, I really like this experience and I want to do it more. And that internship could very likely lead to full-time employment at the business organization. Or, as you said, if the student doesn't want to go directly into the workforce, they could walk away from high school with an internship experience into a college with that experience under their belt, gives them a leg up in their application process to the college, gives them an opportunity to showcase their skills that they developed over the course of their four-year high school experience, and honestly benefits them in the long run.
So are you seeing this more as an opportunity for students to get some soft skills development, time management, you know, understanding their place in a managerially organized workforce? Are you seeing this as in some ways an opportunity for students to get almost apprenticeships to pick up trades.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely developing those soft skills is a huge need. And this program, the course and the internship experience, provides students with that opportunity to develop those soft skills, communication skills, time management, like you said. And then, yeah, it does kind of function like an apprenticeship. These are unpaid internships, and the level of difficulty in the project's really going to vary from industry to industry. And there are certain industries that the students by state and federal law are unable to work in. So, you know, we try and find creative applications and ways for them to be able to at least experience it in some way, shape, or form. We'll take, for example, I have a student very interested in cosmetology and interest in the career of cosmetology. So we're coordinating with Vision Salon. We're going to meet with the owner, Terry, of Vision Salon, and talk with the student and introduce each other, get to know each other. The student could share her passions and experiences with Terry. And we decide if that's something we want to move forward with. If we do, and the student goes into an internship experience, the student can't necessarily be on the floor cutting hair, right? You need certifications for that. But she could be present in the business. She could help out with many other aspects of the business that are much needed. And just by being there and being part of that experience is going to benefit the student immensely.
So are these internships by rule unpaid? I know that for some industries, like they absolutely can't be paid below a certain age to do certain things. Yeah. But say, I mean, in the case of this student who's interested in cosmetology, would they be able to say, so the owner of the salon might say, okay, I want her involved in the managerial side of things. I have certain unskilled labor suitable for somebody who isn't necessarily like a high school graduate. Mm-hmm. But I am willing to pay for these hours. Is that something that can't be done by rule for credit, or would the student be able to?
At this point, the student wouldn't be able to. We're not in a position right now to work through that. Possibly in the future, that's something we could look at. But that is kind of a different beast altogether that we can't really manage.
So what is the ask for businesses? I mean, if a student's getting credit for this class, there must be some bare minimum amount of work that they'd need to do for these programs.
Mm-hmm. It varies between the programs, whether it's a job shadow, externship, or internship. For the internship experience, at least Partico will talk about that because that one's kind of the heaviest one out of all of them. It starts off with a training agreement. So that is an agreement signed by the student, me, the coordinator, the employer, and the parent. And that outlines what does the student need to know to be successful in that workplace environment. After that, the student and the employer go through an orientation checklist. So the student gets to know what the business is all about, dress code, safety procedures. Right now it would be, you know, COVID protocols. How are we adhering to those? The student is maintaining a time log, an accurate time log that gets signed off every month by the employer and the coordinator. There is an evaluation for the employers. So the employers are evaluating the student in conference with the work-based learning coordinator, evaluating the student on certain skills that the student is developing and providing feedback. So what do we need to do to support the student further? What is working, what may not be working in this internship experience? And we're really working in tandem to build that together. The one thing that I did pull from Massachusetts work-based learning program is they had an reflection form that both the student and the employer would fill out together that would really narrow down specific skills that the student needs to learn in order to be successful at the business. And the internship experience allows them the time and opportunity to develop those skills. This is outside of the regular school day. Take, for example, if a student were here at KMXT doing an internship at KMXT and you wanted them to run, I don't know if you're running the DAD system anymore or.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you have a student here who knows absolutely nothing about that system and how it functions and even what its purpose is. So we identify beforehand, these are the skills that you're going to need to learn. Here are the resources that you could utilize to learn that system. And then as you grow in this internship program, we're affording you more and more opportunities to practice those skills, right? Then that student, he or she is working the board during some critical hours. He or she is doing the midday report. He or she is helping Willie out with programming and things like that, working along with Wall to figure out the managerial aspect of it and programming and things like that. So it's really, the sky's the limit in this, mm-hmm. and it's really exciting.
So if say that you are a business or an organization or nonprofit or what have you, and you say, hey, I would love to contribute to the education here on the island. We've got something that a student might be able to do. How would a business get in contact with your office and then begin to set this up? And what would they need beforehand?
Right now, what we're trying to build is a database of employers on the island who would be willing to take a student or students on as interns. I've already had a couple organizations fill out this form. It's a fairly short form, doesn't take a whole lot of time to fill it out. And I've, as I mentioned, had a few other organizations fill it out. The URL is bit.ly/WBLSIS. And we have a website in the works. It's not quite created right now.
I was going to say, you might want something,
but it's
a little.
I know. It's going to go on the website, but that's in the works of being developed right now. But bit.ly/WBLSIS. That's a short link to a form that you would fill out, and it just lists who's the organization, who runs the organization, how can we contact you, what skills does a student need to be successful in that organization, what kind of certifications does a student need to be employed by that organization, how many students are you willing to take on, are you willing to be a classroom speaker, just a classroom speaker, or are you willing to take on students as job shadow experience, and really just helps us build that database so that way as this program grows and we get more students enrolled in the program, and a student says, hey, I'm really interested in journalism. I would really like to get into journalism. And I'd say, well, we have a connection with the Kodiak Daily Mirror and KMXT. Let's talk to both of them and let's see what's going to be the best fit for you and move forward that way. So, yeah, we'll have the website up soon, and I'm sure I'll make a plug ad for KMXT at some point here in the near future and put that on there with a more appropriate URL.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what kind of response have you received so far with the business community who signed on, other than the cosmetology that you mentioned earlier, the salon?
So far, the response has been ecstatic. People are really excited that this program is in development. So many people see this as something very much needed for students who are close to graduating from high school. Even if you go to the salon and you spend that 120 hours there and you decide that that's not what you want to do, look at all that you've done to help the student, to help the business and organization. It's a win-win for everyone. So I've had the opportunity to present to not only one Rotary meeting, but two Rotary meetings, mm-hmm. and talked with the Rotary Club, who, you know, these are business owners in the community and movers and shakers in the community who are helping get the word out. And they were 110% behind it. presented to the school board, who are really excited to see this program in development. And I also connected with the Chamber of Commerce, and they are behind us in helping support us in every way possible. The Kodiak Daily Mirror has said that they're willing to help out to promote the program and look to support us in developing a career development, or sorry, a career fair for students and getting these businesses directly in front of students, probably virtually, but in front of students to talk about what kind of careers and industries exist within Kodiak and what could potentially be your place in that. So I'll be doing a presentation on Friday with the Chamber of Commerce, and they have the event on their calendar on Facebook if you want to RSVP for it.
Okay. So I guess the big obvious question is, you know, we are currently in the midst of a global pandemic.
That's right. I remember hearing something about that.
You just wore the it's a very cool mask with planets on it. It's just a fashion statement. So I would assume that the challenges of getting students either in person to do internships is quite difficult, let alone the prospect of doing totally remote internships.
So how have you guys
tackled those challenges?
Oh, well, I am currently tackling it, is what's happening. Hey, look, I'm not going to let a pandemic stop us from making learning opportunities for students. However, it's not easy. And really, the big thing with the businesses that are willing to take students in this day and age is we say, here are the safety protocols set by the district and what they have deemed necessary to keep students, staff, and the community safe, right? Adhering to those protocols. Can the business adhere to those protocols? And is the business adhering to city and state guidelines and protocols for safety? And as long as we can ensure that, I think we're good to go, you know. In the example of the salon, we had that agreement. She follows the protocols, the student follows the protocols, and we can move forward safely and still afford that student the opportunity.
So what are your metrics for success for a program like this? Are you just looking at job placements? Is it employer satisfaction? Is it student satisfaction? Is it all of these?
It is all of the above. Yeah. Yeah. You certainly want all the businesses to be satisfied with the experience. And that requires a lot of engagement on my part and making sure that I'm there every step of the way and supporting the businesses and the students and making sure that, you know, we have developed a harmonious relationship where we're working for the best interest of the business and we're working for the best interest of the student. And yes, in the end, ultimately, this is a high school program, well, all schools, but primarily high school program. Student happiness, interest, abilities, skills, that's what matters in the end. And we want to provide as much opportunities as possible for those students. I know various programs have existed in the past and currently exist now. And some businesses have had phenomenal experiences in the past. Some business may not have had such great experiences with kind of a work-based learning program. It is my intention and desire to make every single one of these successful for everyone involved. How do I measure success? We're utilizing the evaluation forms. We're utilizing the observation and reflection forms for the students. Is this working out for you, business? Is this working out for you? We're tracking the amount of internships that are happening. We're tracking the industries that students are finding most interest in. And I think with that kind of data, we can further develop and refine the programs that are offered at the high school to meet local and state workforce needs. This work-based learning program is tightly interwoven with the Career and Technical Education Department at the high school. And the CTE department is one that offers a lot of hands-on experience classes for students. And do we need more based on what the students want to get into? And I think a program like this could certainly inform those decisions.
So what's the ambition? Do you see this as a opportunity for a select few number of students, or do you think that long-term this could be something that's a perhaps not totally ubiquitous, but very common addition to the what's being offered by the high schools right now?
Yeah, I see it growing exponentially. I see more and more students becoming a part of this because keep in mind that so students who are currently working right now can also earn that 0.5 credit by documenting their work hours and taking the course. So we're also recognizing students who are already currently in the workforce, and we want to honor credit for that work that they're doing. But as far as further development, it is my vision. This is what I would hope to see, and I think it would be so beneficial. I would hope to see this as a graduation requirement. All students going through the high school program would have to complete either a job shadow, or an internship, or a service learning project where they're contributing to the community in some way, shape, or form. I could see that being a part of graduation requirements, and I don't see anything wrong with that. I see that as like the coolest thing that students could be a part of, right? Because you're further developing this wonderful community, and you're having students be a part of that community. And as I mentioned before, it's a win-win for everyone.
So what was your inspiration to do this program?
I'm all about all subject areas. I love all subjects, even math, which has never been my forte, but
I hear that. Yeah.
All subjects are wonderful. However, I am really keen to hands-on experience. I think we learn best when we're fully immersed in that learning experience, right? It is one thing to watch a video and learn something and then fill out a worksheet, multiple choice, and then you move on to the next thing. It is another to create your representation of learning, to create what you know. And I think this program is like the epitome of creation. You're no longer in this hypothetical learning environment. You are in it. You are part of it. It is a fast moving train, and you need to keep up with it, right? And you'll make mistakes, you'll mess up, and that's fine, because we all do, and we learn from those mistakes, and we grow as people, and we become better for ourselves and for our community.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time. This has been Anthony White, the migrant education teacher for the Kodiak Island Borough School District. I've been your host today for this episode of KMXT's Talk of the Rock. My name is Dylan Simard. Thank you so much for joining us, and I will turn it back now to our regularly scheduled programming.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
This has been KMXT's Talk of the Rock, our local community affairs program. Tune in next Tuesday at 12:30 to hear more about local issues and organizations.